Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfield, read by Robin Holdaway and Annabel Baldwin. Consider the subtleness of the sea, how its most dreaded creatures glide underwater, unapparent for the most part and treacherously hidden beneath the loveliest tints of azure. Consider also the devilish brilliance and beauty of many of its most remorseless tribes, as the dainty, embellished shape of many species of sharks. Consider, once more, the universal cannibalism of the sea, all whose creatures prey upon each other, carrying on eternal war since the world began. Consider all this, and then turn to the green, gentle, and most docile earth. Consider them both, the sea and the land, and do you not find a strange analogy to something in yourself? For as this appalling ocean surrounds the verdant land, so in the soul of man there lies one insular Tahiti, full of peace and joy, but encompassed by all the horrors of the half-known life. God keep thee, push not off from that isle, thou canst never return. Moby Dick. There's a clinical name for it, isn't there? Drowning. Jaws. Sunlight Zone. Miri. The deep sea is a haunted house, a place in which things that ought not to exist move about in the darkness. Unstill is the word Leah uses, tilting her head to the side as if in answer to some sound, though the evening is quiet, dry hum of the road outside the window and little to draw the ear besides. The ocean is unstill, she says. Further down than you think. All the way to the bottom, things move. She seldom talks this much or this fluently, legs crossed and gaze towards the window, the familiar slant of her expression, all her features slipping gently to the left. I'm aware, by now, that this kind of talk isn't really meant for me, but is simply a conversation she can't help having, the result of questions asked in some closed-off part of her head. What you have to understand, she says, is that things can thrive in unimaginable conditions. All they need is the right sort of skin. We are sitting on the sofa, the way we have taken to doing in the evenings since she returned last month. In the old days, we used to sit on the rug, elbows up on the coffee table like teenagers, eating dinner with the television on. These days she rarely eats dinner, so I prefer to eat mine standing up in the kitchen to save on mess. Sometimes she will watch me eat, and when she does this, I chew everything to a paste and stick my tongue out until she stops looking. Most nights we don't talk. Silence like a spine through the new shape our relationship has taken. Most nights, after eating, we sit together on the sofa until midnight, then I tell her I'm going to bed. When she always talks about the ocean, folds her hands together and speaks as if declaiming to an audience quite separate from me. There are no empty places, she says, and I imagine her glancing at cue cards, clicking through slides. However deep you go, she says, however far down, you'll find something there. I used to think there was such a thing as emptiness, that there were places in the world one could go and be alone. This, I think, is still true, but the error in my reasoning was to assume that alone was somewhere you could go, rather than somewhere you had to be left. It's 3 o'clock, and I'm tilting the phone receiver away from my ear to avoid the hold music, which appears to be Beethoven's Battle Symphony played on a toy synthesizer. The kitchen is a junkyard of coffee cups, drain-clogged with tea bags. One of the lights above the cooker hood is flickering, muscle pulse in the corner of my vision like a ticking eyelid. On the counter, the following: an orange, half-peeled, 2 knives, a plastic bag of bread. I haven't yet made lunch. Pulled various items out at random about an hour ago before finding myself unequal to the task. Stuck to the fridge. A sheet of paper with the shopping list scratched down in purple biro. Milk, cheese, sleep aid, and